Hello, I'm Jennifer Bruceris, founder of Independent Women's Law Center, and I am here, as usual, with my colleague, Inez Stepman. This is the 40th edition of At the Bar, what we call a spirited conversation about issues at the intersection of law, politics, and culture. And I was thinking the other day, Inez, when I realized this was the 40th episode, how when we started doing this, it was actually during COVID. And so we set it up as a virtual live happy hour, and we did it in the early, evening after work time, and we brought our wine or our other beverages and encouraged our viewers to do so too. So it was literally a spirited conversation at the intersection of law, politics, and culture. Now it is only metaphorically so, and I do not have my glass of wine, but I do have my Diet Coke. Or Coke Zero, whatever it is. So it's interesting how we started and where we are now.
Now we tend to schedule it at our convenience throughout the day, which is not always the ideal time for a beverage, sadly, because it destroys our hilarious metaphor and double entendre at the bar.
That's spirited. Right. Those make it easier to schedule guests, though, which is good because we have some good ones today, who I'm very much looking forward to talking to about some of the laws surrounding college sports. We have actually talked a lot on At the Bar about Title IX and women's sports in particular and the growing threat to women's sports. But today we're only going to talk about Title IX tangentially. We're actually going to hone in on the question of whether college athletes are, in a legal sense, employees who are entitled to unionize.
Yeah, so a very March Madness kind of topic for this 40th episode. And the topic has been in the news quite a bit. So apparently the Dartmouth men's basketball team voted 13-2 in early March, just a couple weeks ago, in favor of joining the SEIU Local 560 union. So that election was held over the objections of the Dartmouth Board of Trustees, which had asked the NLRB, the board, to overturn the decision by the regional director to hold the election in the first place. So we have here an attempt to unionize among student athletes playing on the basketball team of Dartmouth. If they are allowed to unionize, Dartmouth's men's basketball team will become the first unionized college sports team in the country, which obviously raises a lot of questions about all the other sports teams in college, what the actual nature of playing athletics in college is, is there really a lot of truth, the idea of the student athlete, or is it kind of a fiction? We're going to talk about all of those things with some great guests.
Yeah, so we have two guests here to help us dissect the legal and cultural implications of the Dartmouth men's basketball decision. John Houlihan is an attorney and a professor of sports law at Syracuse University. He is also one of the lead editors on two different books. One is Law for Recreation and Sports Managers, and the other is Sports Analytics, an applied look at how numbers are changing sport. And we also have with us Jeremiah Poff. He's a former education reporter and now political columnist with the Washington Examiner. He has previously worked for the Department of Education, the Cardinal Newman Society, and the College Fix. So welcome, gentlemen, to At the Bar.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We really appreciate you being here. I know you've both covered this topic generally and the Dartmouth situation in particular. I should start off by saying, in the interest of full disclosure, that I have not one but two daughters who were and now are student athletes at Dartmouth, both on the field hockey team. One has graduated, one is currently a student athlete at Dartmouth in her junior year. So I have a particular interest in this case. But why don't you start off, Professor Houlihan, and just kind of give us the background of what happened at Dartmouth and the legal context into which this, story arises.
Sure. The basics of it are that the athletes at Dartmouth, the basketball team in particular, asked the NLRB to intervene and conduct a certification vote. And what they did is they argued that they were employees because of the relationship that they had with the school and the coach. And under the common definition of an employee, or what the National Labor Relations Board was looking at, they were looking at whether the school had significant control over the athletes, whether the athletes were being compensated for the performance of the work, in other words. And when they looked at those two factors, the regional office out of Boston found that the Dartmouth athletes were, in fact, employees. The interesting thing about the Dartmouth case is that Dartmouth's student athletes, as you would know, they don't get paid. They're not on athletic scholarships. So there's no compensation. The board found that it was enough compensation for them with the kit that they got. So all the swag, the sneakers and things like that, that was enough. So they said, you know, there's maybe a couple of thousands of dollars in sneakers and other things like that, that they might get throughout the school year, you know, shirts to wear at events, meeting with alumni, that in itself was enough to make them employees. And the reason Dartmouth is significant, again, is because we had this same case 2015, 2014, when the regional office in Chicago found that the scholarship football players at Northwestern were employees. But in 2015, the full board in Washington, D.C., decided that they were going to reject jurisdiction of that case because they didn't want to disrupt, I guess, the whole college sports environment.
Interesting. So in that jurisdiction, the Chicago area, does that policy still stand or no? That just went away.
It kind of just went away because the full board, the full National Labor Relations Board, rejected jurisdiction. They said that we're not even going to look at this case right now. We're not going to. And the Chicago athletes did actually vote, but the vote was never disclosed. And so they were waiting for the full board to determine the outcome of the case. The distinction between two cases is, you know, besides the scholarship, is also important. Northwestern being the only private school within the Big Ten, the board looked at that and said, you know, it wouldn't be fair for one school within the conference that was private to be regulated by one set of rules and the other ones, which are all public universities, having a separate set of rules.
Right. Well, that, I mean, you raised two very interesting issues. The first, I think, having to do with scholarship. You know, the Ivy League is technically, you know, they're all D1 programs in every sport, but none of them offer scholarships. And of course, the Ivy League is, you know, along with many D3 schools, the classic definition of the student athlete model, right? I mean, all of these kids are there because they have very high SAT scores and grades, and they were recruited not only because they're good athletes, but because they're excellent students, right? So, you know, when my daughters were going through the recruiting process, they have this thing called the Academic Index, which is sort of a combination of test scores and grades, and you get a number. And it's very important to the coaches that the athletes they recruit have high academic indices. And often when they're choosing between players of, you know, similar athletic capacity, the kid with the highest academic index gets the spot. And so this is, you know, it's not a situation like, you know, the big state football programs where the kids get there and their primary job is to be the best athlete they can be and to win games. I mean, of course, they want to do that at Dartmouth too. But their priority is really to get an education. So I think,
interesting you say that, because the Ivy League students have actually filed an antitrust lawsuit against the Ivy League, claiming that they, by denying them athletic scholarships, they're violating the antitrust laws as well. So,
well, that, I mean, that may be in the sense of, you know, there's a lot of, shall we say, collusion between the Ivy League, not just in terms of sports, right, but in terms of a lot of things. Yeah. I would argue, and so that may be they. I mean, the whole reason they don't want to offer the athletic scholarships is because they firmly believe that academics come first. But you know, the other point you raised about private schools versus public schools is an interesting one to me too, because it seems nonsensical to have any regime governing college sports that treat, you know, some members of a conference differently than others, like the NLRB said. And so one question, and we can talk about this later, I guess, is, you know, whether there has to be a one-size-fits-all approach. But I want to bring Jeremiah in and just ask, so, you know, technically, if you apply sort of the common law definition of employee, you could make a very strong argument that these kids are employees of the school. But at the same time, that sort of makes no sense. And I know you've argued that it makes no sense. Tell us why.
Well, the difference between a regular employee and a student is that under normal circumstances, you're paying the institution to attend it, and you're getting an education out of it. So on the first level, what you're doing by treating college athletes as as employees is you're separating them from the rest of the student body as a matter of legal protections. So, you know, that's the first issue. The second issue is that this is a voluntary activity that they are participating in. You know, any student athlete who's attending, you know, we'll stick with the Dartmouth example, they can quit the team and still go to the school at any time. They're not obligated to stay on the team in order to attend the school.
Right. A lot of them do, to be honest with you.
Right. And so it's a fundamental change of the relationship between the student and the institution. And it has, you know, pretty broad effects. And as was mentioned, you know, if we're talking sneakers and t-shirts are the reason why you're considered an employee, well, then every student at the school should be considered an employee. And why are they being required to pay for an education that they're not, that they're allegedly, you know, are employees of? So, to me, it seems like a pretty outrageous assertion, honestly.
We know there are leftists who make that assertion even with regard to students, right? There's this notion of student union, right? On campus. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of follow-up questions I have for the both of you, because and it all involves what's the standard for an employee? Because like you said, this seems like it would extend well beyond in trying to fit student athletes into the definition of an employee. I mean, I can think of a lot of circumstances out, you know, beyond the university context in the business world where, for example, there's a promotion deal and somebody gives somebody some free merchandise, right? In order to promote the brand or whatever it is. I mean, are we going to classify all of those things as employee relationships? And what would actually happen? What would be some of the consequences if this was allowed to go through? And, you know, and I know that there would be really different consequences for, say, you know, some of those big state schools you're mentioning with these huge athletic programs that are making millions of dollars, and then the vast majority of universities that really aren't making money on these programs, and these programs really do exist as sort of student athlete fun competition. It's not on the level, but some of the other programs seem just one step away from professional sports. No, just like from the outsider's perspective.
Well, you could argue, for example, that, you know, they're like the I don't know what they call it, but the Yale Symphony Orchestra, for example, or some of these other clubs that are highly competitive. Some of them may even be recruited for. But once they get there, you know, those students have very demanding, grueling practice schedules, concert schedules, touring schedules. And, you know, a lot of kids at Harvard and Yale and these schools spend just as much time, if not more, you know, pursuing these activities that benefit the reputation of the school, more time even than some of the athletes, to be honest with you, because athletic practices, the number of hours you can spend a week on athletics is limited and regulated by the NCAA. Not so with the symphony.
Yeah, just to chime in here, a couple of things. One of the things we've got to be really careful about is we're looking at these Ivy League schools, and let's look at Duke University, which is playing tomorrow night in the Sweet 16. I don't think a basketball player who drops off the Duke basketball team is probably going to stay at that university very long. If the tuition there is, you know, $75,000-$80,000 a year, while yes, they've been admitted and they can, you know, they can pay for the that tuition if they want to stay, chances are, you know, that's quite a jump. If I walk off the basketball team at Dartmouth or Harvard or Yale, my compensation, what they're paying me for my need-based enrollment there, is going not going to change at all. So I'm not losing my full ride to attend. I'm, you know, I'm getting the same benefits when you go from an Ivy League to a, I guess, a Power Four school.
So would you advocate a sort of tiered approach where, you know, athletes at some schools are considered employees with the, all of the rights that that entails, and athletes at other schools are not? And where would you draw that line?
I think, once again, I would argue that they are all they're all employees. And I would argue that, especially if they're getting scholarships, that they are getting paid. That scholarship to go to a school like Duke or Syracuse, where I teach, those are really expensive compensation for playing a sport. And so the idea that a coach can take that away if the, you know, the student athlete's not performing up to, you know, what they're not supposed to, but the argument that they aren't doing that is, I mean, that's kind of naive.
Let's talk a little bit about what unionization would mean and what the student athletes seek to get out of unionization. I mean, the kids at Dartmouth say, you know, they're looking to be paid $20 an hour and get health insurance. But, you know, what, first of all, what is the, what would the collective bargaining process look like for students? Who would they be bargaining with? The school, the league, the NCAA? And also, what kind of odd incentives does that set up? I mean, you talked about, you know, alluded to the unfairness of a coach not being, not paying someone anymore if they weren't performing. Well, you know, coaches want to spend their scholarship money on the players that are going to help them win. So won't it impact, you know, the competitiveness of the team? I don't know, just throwing that all, that's a lot of questions. But
honestly, I think the biggest effect that it would have is it would kill all other sports programs, because most of these other big schools, most of the sport, men's basketball and football fund basically the entire athletic program. And what that does means, it means that, you know, the kids who's on the swim team or the track team, they're not, you know, that team doesn't generate revenue at all.
And most, so, you know, yeah.
Right. And so if you have a situation where the football team, where the football program has to start paying, has to, all their overhead jumps significantly because now they're paying, you know, $20 an hour with insurance and all this, you're going to have to, there's schools that are going to be like, well, we can't afford to have these other programs anymore because, you know, they're, you know, the money's being, we're focused on what's going to make us money in this case. And, you know, football and basketball are it, which then starts to raise a whole bunch of Title IX issues, because then you have imbalanced sports programs, because, you know, in reality, the vast majority of women's sports programs do not generate anything. It's changing a bit for women's basketball, but and a little bit for gymnastics, but by and large, they don't make any money. So you have a, and then those student athletes are then, well, do we get to unionize? If, and, you know, and then, you know, you, the whole program just get, will just get cut.
Yeah. One of the things, I mean, I think there's a, I'm not sure, I guess personal position, I'm not sure whether I'm in favor of unionization or not. I do believe that they should be unionized and that they are employees. But I guess I'm not as negative on the union as some people might be. I also don't believe that the added cost is that extreme. So, you know, I looked at it at maybe $16 an hour. And if we go up to 20, we're talking, what, $12, $15 million extra, which is, I mean, I don't want to say that that's not a lot of money, but in certain programs, that's nothing. Certain schools, that's nothing. We see, especially at the Power Five level, we see those programs making hundreds of millions of dollars in their athletic department is generating that much. And so if all of a sudden they took, you know, $15 million and distributed that to the student athletes, I don't think that would hurt anyone. I know the Big Ten and some folks out there have argued that television rights should be distributed to the students. And so if the NCAA took its billion-dollar television contract and split that with student athletes all the way down to Division III, once again, I'm not sure the impact is going to be so severe at the individual school level.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because one of the things that, you know, unions bargain about with employers, it's not just wages or health insurance, it's quote unquote working conditions, right? Mm-hmm. So in this case, I mean, let's go back to the Dartmouth example, because frankly, most student athletes are student athletes and not, you know, football players at the University of Alabama trying to make it to the NFL. So let's say the Dartmouth men's basketball team, their union negotiates something related to working conditions about the quality of their locker room and or, you know, the type of meals they get on the road. Well, if the women's basketball team either isn't unionized or is represented, you know, as a separate bargaining unit, and their bargaining unit doesn't bargain for those same upgrades and working conditions, I think the university has a huge Title IX problem on its hands, because you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't, right? Like, women tend to bargain for different things. So taking it out of the college context, with USA Soccer, the women's soccer team, they historically bargained for salaries and like paid time off and maternity leave and things like that. The men's soccer team was pay to play. They never got paid, and they didn't get paid unless they took the field or participated in a training camp. So they had different interests. They bargained for different things. But then the women turned around and sued USA Soccer or US Soccer, whatever it's called, for equal pay discrepancies, but they had bargained for a certain contract, and during COVID they all got paid and the men didn't get paid, right? So sometimes if you have the men's team and the women's team that are bargaining for different things, they end up with different things, and then that puts them, you know, puts their quote-unquote employer in conflict potentially with other laws.
Yeah. If I can just kind of answer that for a second.
And yeah, please.
Jeremiah, you can chime in as well. But I think that you brought up two kind of interesting points. One is, going back to one of your original questions, is who do they bargain with?
Yes.
There's a case right now with USC that's looking at the NCAA as a joint employer with the school and the conference. And so if we can find, if the, you know, they eventually find that the NCAA is a joint employer of the student athlete, then you could bargain directly with the NCAA And the other thing is, why does it have to be different bargaining units? Why can't all college athletes be part of the same bargaining unit? And so you're negotiating, the football players and the field hockey players are all negotiating in the same collective bargaining agreement. So that
they're, I mean, you could, but they have fundamentally different interests based not only on their sport, but on whether they're private or public, based on whether they're men or women, quite frankly, you know, based on so many different variables, right?
Another thing that's noteworthy is that, you know, we talked about the difference between public and private, but there's, even within those schools, there's huge differences in the way that they approach athletics. You know, we've been talking a lot about the Ivy League not giving scholarships to athletes. You go to Notre Dame. Notre Dame's not a part of a conference in mm-hmm. football. So, you know, if you're negotiating with the conference with the union in by and large, then the Notre Dame players aren't going to be a part of that. You know, the military academies also have athletic programs, and every single person at that institution is getting paid a government stipend regardless. And so now, you know, are they going to be a part of this too? There's so many different variables that are with each school having a different interest, quite frankly, that I don't think you can really do a situation where if you were to open this Pandora's box, you can have a situation where all student athletes would be unionized into one union and negotiating equally with the institution and the NCAA.
Yeah. And on top of that, you have Jeremiah, you referred earlier, right, to the fact that one of the consequences of this would be for students who are participating in sports that aren't making money, aren't part of the sort of income stream for the schools, but are being subsidized by those that do. I mean, the interests of the money-making programs versus the non-money-making programs mm-hmm. in the same university will be not just different, but in some ways they should be on the opposite sides of the bargaining table.
And one of the biggest effects of that would be actually the Olympics, because the vast majority of Olympic sport, the pipeline for Olympic sports is through the college athletics program. So, you know, all of our best track stars come are D1 track runners for the most part. Same with swimming, you know, shooting, handball, like all these obscure sports that we only care about once every 4 years. They have the reason that the United States is so dominant in these sports at the international level is because we have this robust network of or infrastructure for these athletic programs. And if you cut them, then you could see a significant drop off in those programs and the amount of money that goes into them because, you know, the only institution at that point that would really have an interest in funding them would be the U.S. Olympic Committee.
John, I'm curious, as somebody, again, who's coming at this, like, I mean, I played very briefly, like a little bit of D2 sports, but I don't have a sort of personal stake in this, and I'm not a big sports watcher. So I'm coming at this completely sort of without any background information. It seems like you think the case, though, at least in some programs, that these students are in some ways, they look like employees. I mean, would you lay out that case for us? Because you're kind of referencing it in passing that you don't think this is crazy in certain circumstances. So what are those circumstances that make you think, hey, actually, this looks a lot like employment?
Go back to the Northwestern case. And the regional office in Chicago was kind of looking at the control that the coaches and the schools had over these athletes. You know, the hours of work that they have to be in before they go to campus or before they go to class. They're reporting to the weight room. They're going to class, coming back for lunch. Then they're practicing. After dinner, they go to, you know, film sessions. They go to bed. Very little time to study.
So let me just jump in here for 1 second and say that the underlying presumption behind looking at that as work is that it's not enjoyable or leisurely in any way. And I mean, to some extent, it's true. It's being a D1 athlete is a commitment and an obligation, but it's also a lot of fun. And, you know, my daughters love going up for preseason. They get to be on campus with, you know, just the other fall athletes. And as freshmen, they got to move in before everybody and get to know the lay of the land before the other freshmen got there. And this is a privilege. And, you know, the athletes at most schools, the Ivy League, the NESCAC, D3 schools, they're not given a lot of privileges the way, you know, football players at Notre Dame are or something. But they are given a certain status, social status on campus. Yes, they get some sneakers and you know, matching jackets and they love that. That's a gift. They feel like this is a privilege. They get to go to Dartmouth, right? They get to go to an Ivy League school. And not that they're not qualified to go there, because these schools maintain high academic standards, but there are lots of kids who, with very high SAT scores and grades, right? Thousands and thousands and thousands, and they can't all go to Dartmouth. But these kids got to go to Dartmouth because they are able to play these sports. And they view that, I certainly want my kids to view that as a privilege. And sure, they have to work for it when they get there, but like being in the weight room extra hours isn't a hardship for them. It's what they love to do.
Once again, going back to the Northwestern case, they found that these coaches were able to control the students' social media posts. They were able to control where they lived off campus. They were able to control the courses that they took, the time they took those courses. They controlled their summer hours because the students had to come back and do some work early. And so the amount of control that these coaches have, once again, whether Dartmouth and Northwestern school in the Big Ten, you want to compare those, I'm not quite sure I want to do that. Mm-hmm. Northwestern.
Yeah, no, they're not comparable in terms of the degree of control.
Yeah,
for sure.
Just to push back for a moment on the particular argument that you're making, I mean, plenty of people view it as a privilege and enjoy their work, right? That the sort of subjective view, but that doesn't mean that our labor laws allow them to be not compensated for that work, right? Like, I mean, I love my job, but right. that doesn't relieve IW of the legal obligation to pay me for it. So I'm not sure like how much of a privilege any particular, like, I don't know, that argument doesn't quite sort of
convince. Yeah, I mean, they're not, how can I put it? I mean, yeah, they're spending a lot of hours doing it, but the kids at these schools spend a lot of hours doing lots of things, you know, the ski patrol, or like I said, the symphony or drama. You know, these are highly motivated kids who want to excel at, you know, the things that they're talented at. And the directors of plays also tell kids, you know, you can't take a class after 3 o'clock if you want to be in this play, because we're rehearsing from 3 to 6 every night. I mean, that happens at every school with every activity if you're doing it at a serious level. And that, I can't see how that makes them employees.
Well, I went to a Division III school, and I was not a student athlete, but the school I went to didn't have a football program. We had a really terrible basketball program. But you know, for those student athletes, it was very clear that they were students first rather than athletes first. And that's the difference, I think, one between a lot of the D1 programs and the D3 and, like, you know, other schools.
Sure.
Is that in a lot of cases, at the University of Alabama, you're an athlete first rather than a student first, quite frankly. But, the degree of control that the coaches and the athletic programs may have on the students, you know, life, you know, I think, you know, scheduling aside, you know, if you're saying you shouldn't take this class because it's not, you know, you should take this class because it's more useful for what you want, you know, for your student athlete. I don't know if that's how that works, but
it's more of a timing thing. Like,
I think that's totally reasonable.
And, well, it's not just timing. It's, we can't let you take this class because it's difficult. We want you to take this class because you have to keep your grade point up. And once again, the NCAA requires that every student's making progress towards a degree. And so it's not unusual for coaches to put students into particular majors because they believe that those majors will allow the students to progress throughout the NCAA's timeline.
Now, maybe that's a problem with recruiting, right? I mean, so you could, like, I don't disagree that that's, you know, problematic, but, you know, I mean, Notre Dame, for example, seems to maintain its academic standards, you know, in a way that Alabama doesn't. We keep coming back to those two schools.
They get blown out of the playoffs.
Right. Well, I mean, but the point is that, you know, that they could say we're going to recruit kids who can do the work in any class they take here. The fact that they don't do that, I don't know that unionization solves that problem. I mean, that is a problem, but I don't know that unionization solves it.
So what about the elephant in the room to me in terms of just like forgetting for a moment about the board standards, just on a gut level, the element to me that weighs in favor against many things that I think you guys have brought up, all three of you, against the idea that these are or ought to be considered employees, is that some subset of these programs, right, are making hundreds of millions of dollars off of the you know, labor of these athletes. Those are exactly the programs that we haven't been talking about, except in passing, right, where oftentimes those athletes are treated as athletes first because they're extremely valuable money-making assets to the university. It seems like that's the strongest case for why. I mean, if the university is making, let's say, I don't know, I'm just making these numbers up, but like, let's say the university is making, you know, $10 million off of some star athlete, and yeah, he gets a scholarship to the University of Alabama to take courses directed by his coach that aren't particularly difficult. You know, it does seem like the university is making a heck of a lot of money off of the labor of somebody that they're not kind of adequately compensating with a degree.
I think that would have more salience before the Supreme Court allowed student athletes to make money off of the name, image, and likeness. But because before the NCAA didn't, you know, basically owned everybody who signed the dotted line to be a student athlete. Now, you know, when you are a student athlete, you're afforded a platform that you otherwise wouldn't have. Like, there's a certain level of fame that comes with that, especially at these big programs. And so, you know, a lot of student athletes are making millions of dollars now while they're in college. You know, are they going to be part of the union? They're going to get $20 an hour. You know, like, that to me seems really, really unfair.
When you say students are making millions of dollars, let's be clear about that. The average student makes about $50 in NIL money. So they're not making millions of dollars.
There's a big disparity, right? There are some that,
right. You know, there are some who are making.
Sam Hartman has his, you know, deals, and, you know, the kids at Notre Dame who, you know, our swimmers don't have their deals, right? But so one argument is that unionization would help level the playing field and give even the athletes who aren't famous enough or pre-professional, give them an opportunity to make some money, right? It would level that a little bit.
If I can just backtrack for a second. I mean, sure. We're looking at unionization as this evil thing. We have unionized students on campus already. We have graduate students who are unionized, who are employees of the university. We have students who are RAs who are unionized, who are students who are employees of the university. We have students working in the kitchens who are employees of the university. There's no doubt that those people are employees. They get a paycheck from the university for the work they perform. So why are athletics so different? I mean,
I think I can answer that in part.
The assistant basketball, you know, the student who works on the basketball team and helps the coach during practice, he actually gets a paycheck. So why can't the basketball players get that same paycheck?
So I would say for a couple of reasons. Well, first of all, I don't think unions are evil. I mean, I let's just be clear about that. My question here, I have some very real concerns about public employee unions. But my particular concerns are with athletic unions for students, right? So I see your point that we have them in these other facets of academic life. But the difference between the kid who's helping the coach with tasks as a manager and the kid who is on the team is the kid who's helping the coach with tasks got into the school and then applied for a job. The kid who is on the team was recruited. They were recruited. They may not, most likely, most of them wouldn't necessarily be at that school otherwise. So they're getting this very big privilege of being able to go to the school of their dreams, whatever that school is. So I do think it's different, but I also go back to, why do colleges have school sports to begin with? For most of them, right? Like, why do they have it? They could just be colleges without athletics or any extracurriculars. But the reason they have athletics, for the most part, is to generate school spirit. And sometimes, you know, with all of everything that entails, including revenue, alumni donations, everything, right? So it's, you're there the students are there to entertain, generate school spirit, alumni dollars, et cetera, et cetera. But it's the sense that you're all part of a community. You are all big green athletes. You're wearing the green, you're there for Dartmouth, right? And so if the basketball team is unionized and the field hockey team isn't, and field hockey is a particularly interesting sport to begin with because it's not mirrored. There's no male equivalent. So they're already getting the shaft, right? But if a men's basketball team is unionized and another team isn't, it feels a lot less like you're playing for the same team. And it feels a lot less like you're there for community spirit than it feels like you're there, you know, for yourself, for your team, to make money. And that's not why we have college athletics.
So why don't you believe the field hockey team could unionize or would unionize?
Why do I think they would or would not?
Yes. I mean, why wouldn't they? If the basketball team is considered employees and the field hockey team could unionize as well.
Sure, they could. I mean, look, my sense is that, and this is just anecdotal, but my sense is that most of the student athletes on the other teams at Dartmouth are not in favor of this, and that they wouldn't unionize for themselves. It certainly changes the relationship between student and coach. And I think that may be more true for women than it is for men. I think in women's sports, you have, especially where there's a female coach, you have mentoring that goes on that isn't going to necessarily happen if they're on opposite sides of a bargaining table. So there's for female student athletes, there's a lot of leadership and other intangible things that they get out of being on these teams. And I will tell you that employers, you know, one of the things I read somewhere is that student athletes someone made the argument that student athletes are disadvantaged because they're not able to do internships or do these other things that can build their resumes for postgraduate work. When in fact, the reality is the opposite. I mean, these, you know, investment banks and private equity firms are dying to hire scholar athletes from the Ivy League. Like, that's who they're recruiting. Those kids have a leg up over the kids who are, you know, just regular students. And so it helps them professionally beyond their time in college. It's another benefit that they already get that you can't really quantify the monetary value of that. I mean, I guess so, an economist could, but
I mean, when we're talking, you know, Ivy League education, once again, that's the one of the arguments about student athletes not becoming employees is that they received this education. They're already compensated. To kind of poke a hole in that myth, we've got a group of students, you know, playing basketball tonight. I think North Carolina State is playing, and I don't want to pick on them. They're playing in the second round of the NCAA tournament. This is the third week in a row that that basketball team has been on the road playing basketball games. What kind of education are they getting? Are they spending a lot of time in the classroom?
Well, during finals, no, right? And that's true of the Yale swim team as it is of, right? I mean, during NCAAs, that yes, they're missing classes, and that's true.
This NCAA swim championship isn't a month long.
Yeah, I mean, there are hockey playoffs and other sports that have longer playoff seasons. But yeah, you're right. I mean, so every sport's different. And, you know, that may be an argument for making the playoff season shorter, for sure. That may be an argument for the NCAA imposing stricter rules about, you know, time that you're allowed to devote to play or practice or whatever. Like, I don't disagree with you that those things are problematic.
They would never do that that's lost revenue.
Yeah, it almost is like, just listening to the three of you, it almost seems like the athletes with the strongest case that they're being in some way screwed by not being considered employees are those who have, like, for whom unionization would actually not really do that much to solve the problem. Whereas the people, so, like, for example, those who, like, would be, you know, those who aren't making a lot of money for the school, right? And probably, I would guess, it goes along with the fact that the more professional a program is and the larger the program is, probably the more intense the hours and the time away from class and the emphasis of practice over class time and et cetera, et cetera. I'm not saying it's a perfect correlation, but if I had to bet, I'm guessing that those things run more together than apart, right? Whereas, like, it seems like the rest of the student athletes who really look more like student, like with emphasis on students, they also seem like they are being, even not as employees, quote unquote, fairly compensated, right? They're compensated by all the things that Jennifer is talking about, you know, starting with the sneakers and the t-shirts, but also, you know, going to scholarships to elite universities, having opportunities to travel and get recommendations that matter later in life, right? All of those things seem like they compensate quite well for the person who is putting in the 30 hours or 40 hours a week in this program, but is also a full student and doing all those things, you know, and isn't making millions of dollars for the universities. Whereas the kids who are in the University of Alabama football team, they are able to make a lot more money than unionization could ever give them through a lot of these deals outside. And it doesn't seem like their interests are much in common with all the other student athletes that we're talking about. It seems like fundamentally we're talking about people with very, very different, quote unquote, quasi-compensation packages from various sources, no?
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons that I don't think there should be a one-size-fits-all approach to this, right? So I don't necessarily think the answer is student athletes should never be able to unionize or student athletes should always be able to unionize. I think there might be very particular circumstances in which student athletes, absent a union, are taken advantage of. And therefore, you know, the union might be the only way for those students to assert their rights and not be taken advantage of. You know, not unlike factory workers, you know, in the 1920s, right? So I think it depends.
You know, I might bring something up that, you know, for conservatives might be a little bit of a, you know, freak out moment, but I don't think that government regulation here is necessarily a bad thing. And I think that there could be some ways where Congress or the Department of Education should really look at how this relationship is between athletes and students, and, you know, come up with a framework for addressing this issue so that you have, you know, a situation, you don't have situations where your coaches are telling students which student athletes which classes they have to take, and, you know, and you know, you don't have the NCAA saying you're going to be out of class for 4 weeks because you're in the NCAA in the basketball tournament. You know, I think that there could be possibly a role for a government intervention there. I know that could be, you know, for conservatives, you know, who might be listening to this, you know, I'm pretty conservative, but I think that this might be one place where it might actually make sense.
Yeah. And trying to get Congress involved since, you know, at least 2020 before the Alston case. I mean, Ted Cruz just had a roundtable last week where he invited all these athletic administrators, college coaches, NCAA officials to come in and talk about the needs of college sports. With everything else going on in Washington, I see that as a long shot.
Well, and the other thing is, I see it as, you know, like everything being so polarized, I don't hold out much hope for sort of a particularized approach. It does seem like you have Burgess Owens saying this is an existential threat to college sports. And you have, you know, Chris Murphy from Connecticut introducing bills like everybody has a right to organize. And it doesn't seem like Congress is really interested in kind of parsing the different types of educational settings that might make, you know, unionizing seem reasonable and those situations where it seems unreasonable. Like
I think to a certain extent that is true in some ways. However, you know, there's been like a half dozen hearings on NIL and college sports over the last 2 years. And you know, having watched plenty of congressional hearings, the tone of them is a lot less confrontational and partisan than a lot of the other ones that I've seen. So I think that there is a potential bipartisan consensus about the need to do something that, you know, and there are a number of bipartisan bills on this that have been introduced. Now, it just isn't a priority for Congress at this point. And right. That's really why I kind of agree with Professor Houlihan that this is not going to happen because it's just not a priority, really. Mm-hmm. And you know, it would take really, I think it would take like high up partisan leadership in, you know, one of the chambers of Congress or even in the White House to push forward with something in order to get something like this actually passed.
Yeah. All right. Well, to be continued then. We will have you back if Congress does move on anything like this so we can discuss it. But thank you both for joining us. Really appreciate it. Really appreciate your expertise and your differing views. At the Bar is a production of Independent Women's Forum. It's available for viewing on Facebook, YouTube, and IWF.org. And you can also listen to it as a podcast on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or anywhere else you get your podcasts.
We hope you'll join us next time for another spirited conversation about issues at the intersection of law, politics, and culture. Until then, cheers. We'll see you next time.